We're continuing our series, journeying through the first five books of the Bible this morning, and we're moving into the book of Leviticus. Yay! God has been showing me some of the real beauty behind this particular book, and I really hope to share some of that with you this morning. We have been watching videos before each talk this term. They're Bible Project videos. They're on our church website and they're on YouTube if you want to watch them again. They give an overview of each book, and I will admit this one changed the way I think about Leviticus forever. So let's have a look. There you go. Leviticus is a book of hope. Who would have thought? It's God making a way where there was no way. It's the first draft of the gospel. We're going to talk more about that in a minute, but I'm just going to recap where we're up to in the story, especially for those who may have missed other parts. So God has created the world, he's made mankind, and he's made it clear that he wants to be intricately and intimately involved in our lives. The first humans have messed it up. They decided to go their own way, and so they've had to leave Eden, the beautiful place on earth that God had made for them. We then followed the line all the way from Adam to Abraham, to whom God has made a promise. A promise to make Adam's line into a great nation, a blessing to all, a father to children as numerous as the stars. We keep following his line through to his son Isaac, onto Jacob, and then onto his 12 sons. And a few weeks ago, Oliver walked us through the way that God chose Judah to be the one to carry the promise of the blessing of the coming king. And as we know, the whole family ends up in Egypt, having heard from God that this is where he's going to make them into a great nation. And he does. By the time they leave, they're absolutely huge. But as Tim mentioned a couple of weeks ago, unfortunately, the Israelites had become slaves in Egypt. And so the beginning of Exodus is one of the most intense and dramatic stories of God rescuing his people that you will ever read. God brings them out of Egypt and sets about making them into his people. They get a law to live by. They get the promise of a land for the nation to live in. And they get the promise of his presence, which Dave focused on last week. God's heart was to dwell among them, literally, in a structure called the tabernacle. Have I got a little clicky thing, or are you doing it for me? There we go. He'd given them the specifications that they needed to build a beautiful tent, and God was going to live in a part of it called the most holy place. These promises were all based on the understanding that the people of Israel would obey the commands of the Lord. If they didn't, then the agreement was broken. However, inevitably, the people mess it up. They build an idol in the form of a calf. They worship it. They have broken the laws that God has given them within days. And now we have a problem, because we have a sinful people and a holy God who has promised his presence, but who hates sin, who cannot be near it because it is so offensive to him. How is God's presence going to dwell among this people? Now, this isn't a problem that is restricted to the Israelite people. It's a problem that carries through for us. They weren't particularly sinful. They're just as sinful as we were or are. Now, this particular incident, we know from last week that Moses acted as a mediator, and God agreed to go with the people and reinstate the agreement because of Moses, because of God's favor over Moses. But we're left wondering, how is he going to do that? What's it going to look like? Remember, God is still currently in the tent of meeting outside the camp. So is he going to leave it like that? Is he going to let go of his desire to dwell in their midst and have a relationship with them as a nation? The answer is definitely no. God is not the type to let go of his desires. It's also worth noting that Moses is not going to be around forever. And I think we all know that the people are definitely going to mess it up again. So how is God going to ongoingly dwell among a people that are sinful and rebellious? As the video mentioned, to really understand the problem and to understand the solution that God provides, you have to understand that God is a holy God. God is completely good, completely unique, all-powerful being that created the entire universe. To be in his presence, if you are anything less than that, is dangerous for you. Not because his presence is bad, but because it is so good, and you're not. Without the cover of God's grace, you would be destroyed. One of the stories in this book is of how Aaron's two sons lose their lives because they don't appreciate that fact. Nothing sinful or unholy can come near to God, not because it will alter him, but because it is so offensive to him. So it's looking pretty impossible right now for God to be able to dwell in this tabernacle that they're building in the middle of the camp. And yet, God makes a way. Time and time again, throughout the Bible, our God shows himself to be one who makes a way for us to be in relationship with him. One who finds a way through our sin and makes a way for him to be able to dwell with us. And he does it without ever compromising his character. In the book of Leviticus, we see how God makes a way where it seemed there would be no way. And we get a glimpse of what he's going to do thousands of years later through Jesus. So, Leviticus is basically God's solution for this problem. Similarly to Genesis and Exodus, it's traditionally understood to have been written by Moses. And although it's got some historical stories in it, it's mostly a manual for the priests of Israel and for the people. It sets out a system of sacrifices and festivals. It explains the exact way in which each one should be conducted, the role that each person plays, and when they should happen throughout the year. This system of sacrifices and festivals will not only help the Israelites to remember all that God is to them and all that he's done for them, it will restore the relationship between him and them when it has been broken or damaged by their actions. The idea was that as long as the Israelites obeyed these commands set out in this book, then God's presence would remain with them. If they didn't, then God would remove his presence from the tabernacle and they would suffer the consequences of that. Now, let's be clear, that doesn't mean that God is going to abandon them as his people. What it means is that he's going to remove his physical presence from amongst them in the tabernacle and that there are consequences to that. So, back to Leviticus. The sacrifices, or offerings, as they're sometimes called, are a mixture of animal and food sacrifices. And they were used to say thank you to God, to have fellowship with him, relationship with him, and to receive forgiveness for their sins. Food sacrifices were very rarely used alone, especially in regards to sacrifices for sin. These required an animal, an unblemished animal, because God should only ever get the best. And there were two ideas behind this. One being that the penalty for sin is death. God has always been very clear that sin leads to death. He's been saying it since creation in Genesis, and that means that when a sin is committed, someone's life, someone's blood must be given in order for justice to be done. Hebrews says that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. But rather than take the life of the sinner, God is willing to view the death of an animal as payment for that sin. The only exception God makes for this is for the poorest of the community. If you could not afford the required sacrifices, then you were allowed to bring grain, food, instead. God wanted to be sure that all could access his grace. He was making a way for all, regardless of their economic status. The second idea behind it is that God wanted to be clear that it's not possible for someone to save themselves. The sin is always taken on by another being, in this case, an animal, and God forgives because of that sacrifice. The priests are an incredibly important part of this system. They all came from the same tribe called the Levites, hence Book of Leviticus. Everyone with me? And they were the ones who cared for the tabernacle, the ones who offered the sacrifices that the people brought, and who conducted the festivals. They were the mediators between God and the people, reinforcing this idea that you cannot save yourself. You need someone to come before God for you to plead your case. The high priest was a role held by one person in the Levite tribe at a time, and he had some particularly important roles to play, and we're going to talk about those in a minute. We're going to focus on one of the festivals that the Israelites celebrated called the Day of Atonement. It's going to be an example of how this system makes a way for sinful people to be in relationship with a holy God. It's described in detail in chapter 16, but I'm just going to read the end because it gives a bit of a summary. So if you're following along, it's chapter 16, verse 29 to the end in your Bible. And it shall be a statute to you forever, that in the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, you shall afflict yourselves and you shall do no work, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For on this day shall atonement be made for you to cleanse you. You shall be clean before the Lord from all your sins. It is a Sabbath of solemn rest for you, and you shall afflict yourselves. It is a statute forever. And the priest who is anointed and consecrated as priest in his father's place shall make atonement wearing the holy linen garments. He shall make atonement for the holy sanctuary, and he shall make atonement for the tent of meeting and for the altar, and he shall make atonement for the priests and for all the people of the assembly. And this shall be a statute forever for you, that atonement may be made for the people of Israel once in the year because of all their sins. And Aaron did as the Lord commanded Moses. What I love about these is the rhythmic nature of these festivals. It shall be a statute to you forever. They did this particular one once a year, every year, in order to remember that God is holy and they are sinful, to receive his forgiveness and his grace and to be aware of his nature. They had a number of them, all designed to help them remember what God had done for them over the years and who he is, to help them remember from generation to generation. When things get tough, it's helpful to be able to look back over the years and remember the times that God has come through for you. To remember the times he's provided for you or healed you. You see, the people do this throughout the Bible. The Psalms are full of people remembering who God is and what he's done because they're in tough times. And there have been numerous occasions in my life when it's been helpful to remember the things that God has done for me. I can look back on my time in Bible college as a time when God provided for me, and that means he can do that now. I can remember that every time I have followed God's plan for my life, I've been blessed. It's not always been easy, but I've been blessed. And that makes it easier to follow him into unknown territory. It gave me faith to follow him here. I wonder, are there ways in which we could regularly remember what God has done in our lives and who he is, ways of rehearsing our stories so that we're equipped for tougher times and so that the generations after us hear our stories? This isn't a way of harking back to the past and complaining about now. It's a way of remembering what God has done and therefore being able to believe for what he can do now. One of the things Oliver and I enjoyed when we first moved here was hearing the stories that people told us of how Walsall Community Church came to be. The things that God had done in your lives. Your stories build the faith of others and they cement in you the truth of your experience in God. Be careful the stories that you rehearse. Make sure they're positive ones. They're the ones that you're going to live out again in the future. So this particular festival, the Day of Atonement, it was the highlight of the year for the Israelites. It was a festival in which the whole community could receive the forgiveness of God for all their sins. It was a dramatic, intense festival that provided them with a new beginning each year. Every year they got the chance to be cleansed from every sin, all the ones that may have gone unnoticed, even by the most devout, any that they're still feeling bad about, all forgiven. It was a festival designed to help the Israelites understand that God hates sin, really hates it, and that it affects everything, but that he is a gracious and forgiving God whose heart is to be with them. It was held about this time of year. The seventh month for the Israelites was September, October time. And it involved everyone, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. This was a very communal festival. It involved sacrifices for groups of people, not just individuals. It was a good reminder that they're a people, a nation, that they're connected to one another. They're foundationally alike. It was quite a solemn festival. The Israelites had agreed to be the people of God, to represent him and his kingdom amongst the nations. And this was a day of reflecting upon that call, reflecting on the ways in which they had succeeded in living up to that call and in the ways in which they had failed. It should always be a solemn time when we reflect on the sins that we've committed against God. The people are told that they must afflict themselves, which sounds really harsh, but its meaning is along the lines of denying themselves or humbling themselves. It included fasting or wearing sackcloth and ashes, kinds of behavior that helped you remember your position in comparison to God. It was a way of preparing themselves for the rituals and sacrifices that were to come that day. This is one of the festivals in which the high priest played a pivotal role. He was going to be the one to make atonement for himself, for the priests, for the people, for the tabernacle. But he had to prepare himself to come before God because he was going to have to enter the most holy place. And when all was said and done, he was also just a sinful man. He was the only person ever allowed to enter the most holy place. And he was only allowed to do it on this day for these specific purposes. It was really important that he went through the proper procedures before he went in, so that he was considered clean. Otherwise, he would encounter the presence of God and he'd be destroyed. He had to have a bath in order to be symbolically clean. He had to make a sacrifice for his own and his family's sin so that he was ritually clean. And he had to wear simple white garments that expressed his humble position before God. Once he'd made the sacrifice for his own sin, he had to go into the most holy place to put some of the blood on the altar. Now, this would have been a really tense moment for everyone, for him, for the community, because this was the moment where they found out, had he done everything he needed to do in order to survive going into the most holy place? This was really real for them. Remember, they've experienced what happens when people don't obey these commands. When he comes out, he is a living example of how this system, how the sacrifice that he made and the rituals he followed have made a way for him to be able to go directly into God's presence. Having been forgiven himself, he's now in a position to be able to offer sacrifices for the sins of the people. He can't seek forgiveness for anyone else until he's been forgiven himself. So the sacrifice for the people was two goats, one of which was put to death, and the other was termed a scapegoat. The high priest sacrifices the first goat and then goes back into the most holy place, another really tense moment for everyone. He offers it before God as a sacrifice to pay the price for the sins of all the people. He then has to cleanse the most holy place itself, the tabernacle and the altar, because they've all been in contact with sinful people. It highlights for them that their sin contaminates everything. This is not just a human problem, this is a creation problem. So far, everything has been done in private, just between God and the high priest. The people are waiting outside, waiting for him to come out. When he does, the high priest lays his hands on the second goat, the scapegoat, and transfers all of the sins of the community onto it. It's then sent or led out of the community, out of the camp, taking all of the sins away. It's a powerful visual representation of God removing the sins of the people completely, as far as the east is from the west, as the Psalms would say. It makes public what God has done in private. Both the goats that were sacrificed and the one that was sent away preserve the idea that the sin has to be taken by another being. You can't save yourself. And after all the ceremonies are finished, the people are considered clean before God. They've been forgiven and they're able to live in peace with him. He's found a way for there to be an ongoing relationship with them, to dwell with them whilst acknowledging the truth of who they are and who he is. I hope you can see how passionate God is about being with his people. You see, that now includes you and me. And God is just as passionate about being with us as he was about being with the Israelites. And we're just as sinful as they were. Unfortunately, God knew that this particular system was not going to be enough. It was his grace to the Israelites for a time, but it was not the final story. In Hebrews, God says, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will establish with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, for I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." You see, God wanted to make a way for all of mankind to be able to be in relationship with him fully, permanently. And so he took the ideas we've talked about today and he used them in a way that no one could have imagined. By sending Jesus to come and die on the cross, God combined both sacrificed and high priests in one perfect being. Jesus was the sacrifice that would only have to be offered once, because he is enough to cover every sin ever. He took our place and took our punishment and acted as our scapegoat, removing all of our sins as far as the east is from the west. God is willing to accept his death as payment for our sin. He's willing to view you as clean because Jesus is clean. He is our high priest who did not have to be forgiven himself before he could seek our forgiveness because he's sinless. He was obedient to his Father to the letter, and he's able to sit at God's right hand and be our mediator. Through Jesus, God has made a way for us to be in relationship with him, a way that is on offer today. He desires to be with you, to be near you. And that matters for our lives today. For those of us who know God, we can be grateful that he's made a way for us. For anyone who doesn't yet know that God wants to be in a relationship with you, I'd love to chat with you this morning. I'd love to introduce you to the God who is passionate about you and who wants to get to know you. Finally, our God is a God who makes a way where there is no way. And if you need to see that in your life, in your circumstances, in your family, in your health, in your work today, then we'd love to pray with you. Maybe if some people who are from the prayer team could be available about now, that would be really helpful. And maybe if the band could come back. I know it's not easy to come up and get prayer. I know that it can feel like everyone is watching you or judging your decision. But generally, the people in this room, they want to see you moving forward with God. They want to see you walking in freedom. They want to see you healed. So come forwards and get prayer. Come and see God make a way in your life in a way that nobody else can. Let's move forward with God today.